This episode is brought to you by Mutinex Growth OS,
the marketing mix modeling platform that makes measuring ROI fast, easy, and cost effective. And this is my best radio voice.
That's the most creative thing you've ever said.
How's this for a call to action?
Mutinex Growth OS, your best decisions start here. Request a demo at mutinex.co. That's mutinex.co.
Hey, John, you've done a podcast before, haven't you?
I'm not sure, mate. I might need to brush up on it.
Welcome to another episode of Black T-Shirts. Today on the show, we have John Evans, the uncensored CMO, as he's called, with his very famous podcast. John's UK-based. He works for the famous research company System One. And funnily enough, he's actually in Sydney, which gave us the opportunity to talk to him for Black T-Shirts, although Adam's in Melbourne and I'm in Tokyo, of all places. But nevertheless, we've got together and recorded an episode of Black T-Shirts. We're excited to have John on the show. And welcome, John. Welcome to Black T-Shirts. John Evans, are you wearing a black T-shirt?
I can confirm it's official. The man is in a black T-shirt. Yes.
Well done. Well done. Now, is that a usual uniform for you? Do you wear it very often?
I have to say I do, actually. And I don't. Do you know what? It's not a style decision. It's a laziness decision, because black goes with everything and it just reduces my decision making in the morning. And I actually quite like black. I know a lot of people like don't like black, but I love black. I think it's a great color.
Hey, John, on what you just said about reducing decision making, probably about 8 of the 10 people we've spoken to so far in this series have said exactly that.
Yeah.
And do you reckon that's a worry? Do you think we're all just conforming and the cognitive load of life is getting so great that we're all just kind of minimizing all of that shit and trying to get it out of our life? We're all becoming more and more uniform.
100%. I mean, the amount of decisions we have to make and the amount of like different bits of tech we have to use, the amount of information thrown at us, it's just like a choice overload, isn't it? And I should probably act to my own advice at some point, but I think the biggest hack in life, if you're building anything, is make it easy to use. And I think you don't have to have the best product. You just have to have the easiest product. And I think I'll go for convenience every single time. I mean, whenever I get like a, you know, your app is being updated with new features. I'm like, I've only just learned to use the previous one, you know? I'm definitely in camp. Don't change it, you know, keep it the same.
Yeah. And you've had an unusual career. You've been a kind of a pretty classic marketer, got fired famously a couple of times for various things, and now find yourself as a CMO of a market research company. I'm sure you've got a better name for it than a market research company, and also kind of doing your own very successful podcast, Uncensored CMO. Why did you make the switch?
Oh, well, I'd love to say it was all a big strategic idea and it was planned out and all thought through, right? I'd be lying. It was probably circumstantial mainly, I think. You're quite right. I've spent most of my career client side doing marketing roles, reasonably decent positions on decent brands. I've worked on small brands, startups, scale-ups. I've worked on big, you know, brand leader brands. So, had a great career, done some cool stuff. Ended rather abruptly when I got fired twice in the same year. So I took it as a hint. And at the time I got fired for the second time, which was only about 9 months up the first time, there wasn't really any jobs in the marketplace, right? There was nowhere obvious for me to go. So I did what a lot of people do. And anyone listening who's in this position, I feel for you, because I had to go freelance and I had to earn my own money effectively, you know, week by week. And that was a bit of a shock to the system. And what I found is, there was a lot of demand for me from agencies who really wanted to understand what a CMO does. How do you pitch to a CMO? How do you build relationships with prospective new customers, right? So I found myself in a very unusual position, having kind of been a marketer where everyone's trying to pitch to me. I suddenly find myself out there on my own helping people pitch to their potential new customers. It's a very weird kind of change in the power dynamic, you know. Because I tell you what, I mean, CMOs, you guys know this, right? But you have every agency pitching at you, doing whatever they want, taking you out. You know, you get inundated, right? suddenly it's the boot is on the other foot. And one of the first customers I had as a freelancer was System One. Now, System One, I'd been a customer of System One. And actually what I loved about them is I'm the last, if you did a queue of people that are research nerds, I'm at the back, right? I'm the least research nerd.
And actually, I'm right behind you. I'm right behind
you.
You
know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just like, I know I must upset a few people, but I'm like, just tell me what I need to know. What's the one thing I need to know? Can you just limit it to that? And we'll crack on, right? Anyway, which actually going back to our conversation on Make It Easy will prove to be quite important. So I love System One because it kind of made sense, right? We make decisions based on emotion a lot more than we do. You know, we're not the kind of clever, thoughtful gurus that we like to think we are. We tend to sort of do things on instinct. So anyway, I kind of bought that philosophy and I'd use System One actually when I was a CMO at LucasAid and Ribena. And I just found it easy to use. I found it pretty much right. And it was simple. Right. And I could implement it. And actually, I use their system. And we used to go into board meetings and, present System One data and everybody understood it. Everyone got the action. It was great. Anyway, so when I was freelancing, I basically had a number of different customers, but System One was the company that I really enjoyed working for. I just found it was interesting. Actually, I started at a really good time because they were just, everyone talks about digital transformation. They were turning from a research company to a platform. So you asked us how we describe System One. I mean, everyone comes up with their own slightly fancy way of saying it, but we kind of describe ourselves as a marketing decision-making platform, right? Which I know is a bit, everyone's like, oh yeah, it sounds a bit fancy. But that's what I joined really is that what we'd done is we'd basically tried to automate the process of advertising testing to reduce the time down to less than 24 hours, to make the output incredibly actionable. And then to make the advice and guidance really instinctive. And at the time, it was great actually, because when I came in, I was like, right, I am your customer. You've got to make it really easy for me to use this, you see. So rather than kind of getting, bogged down into all the kind of science and methodology and market research kind of arguments that, those kind of guys have, I said, make it simple, make it fast, make it actionable. And if I can understand it, this is going to fly, And yeah, I've been proved about right. It's the thing that I worked on, Test Your Ad, which I came up with the name, and the Pro Report, which I designed at the time, right at the beginning, is now about 3/4 of our business.
Yeah, right.
So wow. It's become, in the UK particularly, but it's become probably one of the default sort of approaches to ad creative.
So, John, would you call yourself a B2B marketer?
I would 100%. Yeah. And proudly so actually. I really enjoyed it because the last 5 years, so firstly, I've had to get myself into research kind of, job, which is, wasn't on my bingo card of things to do, but actually, I'm joking about it, but do you know what I really loved is as a marketer, you have to go so broad and you have to skim everything and you're connecting lots of dots. You're working across an organization. I mean, for me, working in manufacturing, it's like you're in the factory one minute, you're dealing with a supply chain issue the next, you're with the customer the next. And you don't really go deep into how marketing works. And what I love about what I do now is I really get to understand the science behind, how marketing should work, the theory. But of course, I've got the experience. So I kind of marry those two things up, which is like, I really enjoy the sort of, oh yeah, that's why that works and that doesn't. And when I'm with customers as well, I can say, well, look, I get it, right? I've been you. I've got it wrong. I've got it right as well. And I understand why this is useful. So, but to come back to your question about B2B, I find it a really, really fun challenge because effectively you're trying to target a much, much, much smaller audience, but they're much, much harder to reach and much, much more influential in terms of decision-making impact they can have on your, on your business. So it's a very, I say it's a different challenge. It's a very specific challenge, but also the rules, quote unquote, are fairly similar, right? People make decisions under similar circumstances. You need to build a brand. You need to think how you convert. You need a funnel. All those kind of things that, you do in B2C, you kind of do in B2B. So I've thoroughly enjoyed it. But yeah, 100%, I'm a B2B marketer.
John, not only you're a B2B marketer, you're probably a B2B brand in your own right. And part of it is just staying salient. was the relationship between John Evans, Uncensored CMO, and System One? And what came first out of System One and the Uncensored CMO? Like, were you starting that when you were freelancing, or how did that all work?
It's do you know what? It's a beautiful relationship, and it's very, very symbiotic, and it works incredibly well. So the sort of origin story is, so I had my period when I'm freelancing after getting fired. And I'll tell you the story. So I was kind of marketing myself as a freelance CMO, as kind of people do. System One was one of about four businesses I was helping at the time. And I was working, I think, officially half a day a week for System One at this point. Anyway, they invite me down to Cannes because they asked me to join them on a panel on the beach to talk about creativity. And while I'm there, I have a chance meeting with CNBC. So CNBC are filming on the beach. They're doing a series of CMO interviews. They hear that I'm a CMO and they say, look, can I come and be on camera and talk about, you know, what I think of Cannes? And anyway, I go down to the beach. Now, I'm freelance at this point. I can say whatever I like, right? Which is nice. So the first thing they say is, like, what do you think of Cannes? I say, look, I'm a bit disappointed because there's one person not here, and that's the customer. We're all talking to ourselves. We're not representing the customer and what the customer thinks, and they are the people we serve. And if they are happy with the work, we will sell more and the industry will be successful. But I want to see the customer in Cannes. You know, we need to stop talking to ourselves. Anyway, the guy stopped the camera. He pokes his head round and he goes, bloody hell, mate. He said, you're the first Uncensored CMO I've met all week. And I thought, ooh, I like that. I think there's something in that. So anyway, so that was the name. And then in terms of the opportunity, what I'd been asked by all these four different agencies was exactly the same question. The first question was, how do we pitch ourselves to CMOs like you, right? Now, that was actually fairly easy to do because, you know, I sat on the side of the table for 20 years. That's no problem. The second question they asked me was much, much harder. The second question they all came to me with is, how do we meet CMOs? I'm like, oof. I said, you know what? This is where I'm going to have to sort of give you the bad news, right? I've never responded to a cold call in my life. Genuinely, I have never, right? I would never do it. If you send me an email, phone call, right? The kind of jobs I've had before, I had a PA that read my emails and filtered out anything that wasn't absolutely urgent and important, right? That's what you're dealing with, right? And I only need to talk to you about a new PR thing or a new creative campaign or whatever when I need to, right? So it doesn't matter whether you want to sell to me. If I don't want to buy, what's the point, you know? You know, you're going to find it very difficult. So they all said to me, well, what's your one bit of advice? And my one bit of advice was create content so valuable for free that gets your brand across to your target audience that when at some point in the future, and you don't know when, at some point, they will remember you. But you have to make yourself so valuable to them with no ask in return. And they're like, what? But that's like, that's really hard work. That's going to be like, really? We're going to have to do that? I mean, geez, that's like a big ask. So anyway, I had to apply that to myself, didn't I? Right. So I was thinking, what value can I create to senior marketers that mean at some point in the future, they might think about me? And so I decided to create a podcast. And my idea was to interview the best marketers in the world and the best marketing theories, you know, discuss the biggest, most important marketing theories in the world, meet the experts. And try and create content so good that, you know, the people I want to talk to will phone me up and they will ask for me rather than me having to ask for them. That was the theory.
And you also got to meet, obviously, all the CMOs in market.
I did. Well, I'll tell you a little secret as well. It's quite funny. So I just started working for System One. And of course, they said to me, John, you must know all these senior CMOs. And I'm scratching my head going, do you know what? Honestly, I know you think I'm probably well networked, but my network as a CMO were my customers, my internal audience, my agency partners, my suppliers, right? I didn't have time to hang out at the CMO beach club on a Friday. That thing doesn't
I don't think anyone would want to hang out at the beach club. Yeah, is there one? I didn't know there was one.
I don't know. We should create one, right? I think the black t-shirt beach club should be a thing. It'd be pretty cool, right? But it doesn't happen, does it?
No, and as you rightly say, you know, we're busy, you know, we're busy at work, we're busy with life. But just on the story of the pod, so, you know, you talked about the origin story of the pod, but, you know, did you have in your wildest imagination, did you ever think it would be as huge as it's become? And do share with our listeners how huge it is, John. Don't be humble.
Yeah, 100%. Hands on heart, I had no flipping clue. I mean, the first thing to admit to is I didn't know anything about podcasting, right? Genuinely.
Neither do Adam and I.
Yeah. I'm still hoping someone tells me how to do it, right? I genuinely know. I got a bit lucky. There's a guy working for me at the time, and he was a complete like podcast nerd. And he just said, "Mate, you should have a podcast. You know, you're good at talking. You know, you like meeting people. You should do it." And he sold me on the B2B power of podcasting. And I would like to say I had this big vision that it's going to work out like this, and I didn't, but I saw enough in it and I listened to him enough to go, this is definitely worth a go. And, you know, at first you go, oh man, we've got 1,000 downloads. This is great. And then it's like 10,000, it's 100,000. It goes on from there, sort of thing. And so I think but actually the thing to probably be honest about as well is it takes a long time. It's like, it's not like it was straight away. And if you look at, if you could see the graph of downloads, you'd probably see 3 years. Of kind of grafting and not a lot, and then 1 year of like takeoff sort of thing. So it's definitely not been an overnight success. It's taken quite a lot of time to get to where it is.
Brent and I have a podcast called Black T-shirt. we've got a similar thing. You can see this graph, right? But one time we couldn't get a guest, and so we got somebody to come and sub in for the guest, and we made that guest pretend to be Ryan Reynolds.
And so
on the actual title,
it was Adam's idea, by the way. It was Adam's idea.
But our graph kind of goes like this with a massive spike, but still kind of keeps on getting spikes with everybody wanting to tune into Ryan Reynolds.
That is genius, mate. That is genius. I love that.
Hey, is the podcast yours or System One's?
I created a podcast while I was freelancing. In that period of time where I was kind of freelancing for a number of different businesses. And the original idea was it would serve as a vehicle for me to meet the kind of people that I can help introduce to new customers, introduce to new agencies, et cetera, et cetera. Now, what then happened is my System One work was getting, I went from half a day a week to 2 days to 3 days. So eventually, they approached me and said, well, look, do you fancy joining full time? And by that point, I was emotionally invested. So, I'd come up with the proposition I thought they should do. I'd come up with the sales deck. I'd started to network on their behalf. And so actually I felt, and I'd been a customer, right? I already had a passion for what they did. So I decided that actually I would do it, which was a hard decision actually, because I was starting to really enjoy the freedom of like, being kind of, uncensored CMO kind of on tour or whatever. But the one thing I said to him, look, I want to do this podcast thing. And actually, look, if I'm being honest again, I had one eye on my next job because I was thinking, I don't know how long this research thing is going to go for. Because to be quite honest, I'm not your classic hire. And also, I'm not sure that CMO of a research company is actually the kind of, big standout on my CV that I might have thought. You know what I mean? So I thought I've got to hedge my bets. So, I was hedging my bets, right? But this is the thing, right? And this is where it all kind of works nicely. I did try and convince them that actually having a podcast that's not branded System One, that is me, as my brand, meeting potential customers, would actually benefit System One. And on that measure, boy, has it outperformed any expectation I ever had. I mean, the amount of business that it is created for System One is just eye-watering. I mean, it's just incredible. And it's,
It's fantastic. And the reason why I just want to dwell on it for a little bit is somebody once said to me, there's no business model in flying under the radar. And it's just such good advice. But as a business, it's good advice. But also as an individual, it's good advice. And I reckon a lot of people listen to the podcast so that they can understand the person who they want to pitch to or they want to get to know or so on. So they're doing it as a proxy to get to know somebody. And as a business, we do that all the time, but as individuals within a business, we kind of shirk at that a little bit. And it's just interesting, the people who make business happen are the ones who are kind of often getting out there and making a name for themselves as well as the business they work for. it's a different dynamic to, I think, what we get trained to believe or trained to do. And so, you know, it's kind of interesting, the people who kind of go out there and do it, make a name for themselves, the more famous they are, the more famous their business is going to be. It's obviously a self-justifying rant as well, a little bit, because Brent and I are in the same boat. But I do wonder why it doesn't happen more often. And I wonder what the barriers are for individuals to kind of go out there and and do that a bit.
Oh, mate, I can definitely answer that one. I think because there's a, if I'm honest, there's mistrust, actually, is the reason. So I had quite a lot of battles at System One because, well, a number of levels, right? People were saying, why are you wasting your time on a side project, you know, and bear in mind in the early stages, you guys know that the very early stages, right? You're not getting millions of people. You know, I remember celebrating when 100 people downloaded an episode, right? That was like, woohoo, you know what I mean? And you're thinking, you know, I could turn up to any marketing conference and meet 100 people, right? So, you know, at the beginning, like, you know, it does look like, and it's a lot of work as well. I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, you guys know this as well, but you know, the hours you put into prep, the hours you put into promotion and actually doing the thing, it's not a small amount, right? So at the beginning, there was a genuine tension on, you know, why is John spending all his time doing his own thing, right? Because it's branded me, right? So it's obviously his thing. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, like, then people go, why is this not a pink podcast with System One logo all over it, right? And I'm like, do you know what? No one is going to listen to some branded company podcast talking about itself, right? Rule number one is add value to the customer, right? You don't add value to the customer by going, dear customer, this is an advert for System One for the next 60 minutes, right? You know what I mean? It's like, that's not going to work. So the second thing, you know, people struggle a little bit with, you know, advertising doesn't all have to be direct, right? It can be indirect, you see? So what I hope is that, you know, I create some hopefully great content with great people that is of high value to the people I want to talk to. And as a consequence of doing that, they will naturally hear stories about how System One has helped, you know, help companies create great advertising that's delivered results. And they're going to hear that naturally. They don't need me to force it on them, sort of thing. So I think the second thing was probably, I don't think many people understood that actually the podcast being separate to System One was actually genius in terms of how it credibly got the word out there. And, you know, I wouldn't be in the position I'm in had it been the System One podcast. So that was, I've done it for 4.5 years now. It took over 3 years probably to get to a tipping point where everyone's going, oh, so yeah, the podcast drives business to System One. Got it, right? You know, so it took a while. And unfortunately, I'm in a lovely position now where, and by the way, any System One people listening will recognize this, that I'm very, very well supported by the organization. I must say that as well, because it sounds a bit like no one understood what he was doing. And it was like that in the beginning. But now, honestly, they are so supportive because, you know, they can see the results.
I bet they are. If there was going to be a soundtrack to this podcast, it would now have a bit of impending doom coming into the kind of the lovely, affable conversation that we've been having. Because the very blunt question is, do you honestly believe that System One is helping with the creative output of advertising?
Do I honestly believe? I do, yeah. And the reason I do is it probably goes back to what I probably said earlier, is that I'll tell you a really interesting insight here as well about System One. And this is where we've recently done some repositioning work of our own, like, what do we stand for, right? And led by a marketing director who's got to something that absolutely hits the nail on the head, which is create with confidence. And the word confidence is the key. So I've been in a position where I have, like, it's not that I haven't been able to come up with a great creative idea. I've worked with brilliant agencies and we've done some brilliant creative ideas. The problem I've had is justifying it to the business. Being able to go back to the business and say, I am confident in this direction because, right? And what System One does amazingly is it gives you a way to value the potential for an idea and put a score on it, put a number on it. So we often talk about the rational case for emotion, right? We know emotion drives, you know, drives how creativity works. We know that leads to good business results. But how the hell do you measure emotion? I mean, it's really difficult. So what we've done is I know it's a bit system two, right? I mean, yeah, it's the system two way of marking the system one homework. But what's amazing about system one is it's, and actually I say this to creatives all the time, I'm not here to mark your homework. I know you think I am. I know it's a score. I know it feels like you've got a 1 out of 5 and it's going to feel terrible, right? I get it. We're here to make great creative work happen. And the way it happens is for the people that decide whether it happens, you know, the CFO, the CMO, the CEO, is to give them the confidence that this is going to work in the short and the long term. And that's really what we're doing. And I know that because that's the why behind the why. That's because as a customer, that's what I used it for. You know, it wasn't so much going back to my creative agency and going, yeah, you should have put a logo at the front. You know, I mean, that's there. We can help with that, you know. But the real game changer is putting a value on the role of creativity. And you guys know this, right? Because we've all listened to the same talks about Ritson and everyone else, you know, the Dyson chart about creativity is the second biggest thing you can use, or the half the result is creative, half the result is media. I mean, there's loads of data out there to show you, but you've got to put a value on it. And that's what we do.
And if you think about, you know, your time at System One and how much you've learned about how advertising actually works, what would be the biggest bit of advice that you'd give to any CMO? So sure, I hear what you're saying, like, you know, have the confidence, measure it, prove it. But when it comes down to the actual, you know, creative output itself, what would you say to any CMO? What, based on what you've learned, what should they absolutely be thinking about as they create something?
Yeah. This is probably a little bit surprising because, look, I mean, given we're called System One, you'd probably expect me to say emotion, right? And because I know that's baked into how we make decisions like that. And it actually wouldn't be that, although that's important. I think you guess that quite quickly. The most important thing that I've learned through all the research is actually what my colleague, Orlando, would describe as fluent devices. And look, I mean, you know, we're all students of Byron Sharp and we all understand mental and physical availability and we all understand kind of distinctive brand assets. But what I've noticed in all the best campaigns, all the best results, all the best, you know, the ones that have delivered the most substantial business change is they've come up with an ownable property, something that is clearly them and is clearly ownable and builds over time. So if you take, so I'll try and take an Australian example now, but like I was in Specsavers like last week doing an interview with their CMO. Now the whole should have gone to Specsavers. That's an idea, right? But that idea must be worth hundreds of millions of pounds because there are lots of places you can go to get a pair of glasses. But the fact they've created an idea that is funny, that has got the brand embedded in it, that turns up in social media, it turns up, you know, in the store, in the opticians, it turns up online, you know, it turns up in all sorts of places. The power of an idea that is distinctively yours and creates an emotion, I would say, is the thing that I've learned. So if I were like CMO day one on brand X or Y and I turn up, first tip is I'd go back and look at the past, right? I would go, what has worked in the past? What is ownable about the brand's past? What have they created that is in the mind of the consumer? Now, most people don't do that, but I would audit the past and go, what do I want to carry from the past and keep growing in the future? So what doesn't change would be my first question. And then what I would do is go, how can I make the thing that's unique about me that creates an emotional response in my audience, how do I make that completely and utterly ownable? So if I was at the Super Bowl, I wasn't actually at the Super Bowl. Sorry, I was in the US while the Super Bowl was on, watching the Super Bowl ads, talking about them for System One, right? And one of the coolest ads was Oreo, and you know the Oreo cookie thing, right? And the way that people like twist it to, you know, and which side is the cream on, right? And they had this brilliant ad where it's like, you know, points in history that were decided over the twist of is it left or is it right, and this sort of thing. And what they've done brilliantly is they've taken what is uniquely theirs, they've taken a behavior that is a true insight, and then they'd owned it as a distinctive, a fluent device. Orlando would call it something that is easily as associated with you.
And what I like about the two examples you gave, right, you know, Specsavers and Oreo, is you didn't go to a character, you know, like a brand character. You've actually gone to
wrong with going to? So my mind went straight to a character, and I was kind of wondering, is that too reductive? But if it works, it's an idea, it's ownable to the brand, it can carry all of your messages if it's well, if it's got a character behind it.
I think that's the sort of obvious answer when we hear fluent device, personally.
It's the fluent answer for a fluent device.
I don't know how fluent it is. I don't know. For me, it's limiting creatively. And I think having an idea like Should Have Gone to Specsavers, which I love, and I think they've executed in so many interesting ways over the years. I just think a lot of marketers go straight, when they hear the word fluent device, they go straight to, I need some sort of brand character, you know?
Yeah.
But I think that's the, I don't say it doesn't work. I just think that's the obvious.
This episode is brought to you by Mutinex.
Are you going to start talking about Mutinex again?
Yep. It's that amazing marketing mix modeling platform that helps marketers make better investment decisions.
I thought it was more complicated than that.
No, not according to the script. They measure the true impact of marketing on your bottom line using clever computers and people.
Mutinex Growth OS. Your best decisions start here. For more information or to request a demo, visit mutinex.co. That's MUTINEX.co.
We know Henry too. We had him on the show. Great bloke. 97% human, 3% cyborg.
Answer. Yeah, you know,
it's kind of like, yeah. I'm a big fan of characters. It's probably route one. You know, to use a football analogy, it's like you know you're hitting the ball straight to the striker to try and score a goal, and it's very effective. The kind of, I don't know, I was running out of football analogies, but anyway, the sort of Barcelona tiki tacky way of playing football, which is a bit more pretty and a bit smarter, might be coming up owning an idea sort of thing. I mean, Yorkshire Tea. Sorry, I'm using British example. Apologies to everyone listening here. But Yorkshire Tea, check them out, by the way, amazing example, because they own, so, you know, people in Yorkshire would talk about a proper cup of tea, and the word proper they've owned to such an extent that in their creative advertising, they basically made everything they do proper. So for example, if you turn up to a job interview, they'll have Michael Parkinson kind of, you know, as if you're turning up to a game show interviewing you. When you phone them up, the whole music will be the Kaiser Chiefs because they're from Yorkshire, you know what I mean? You know, at the induction, they got Sean Bean delivering the induction speech, you know, in their creative. It's absolutely brilliant, but it turns up everywhere. The idea of doing things properly is brilliant. So no, I agree. But listen, let me quickly pitch you characters. I'll do that with a Super Bowl. So let me put you a quiz now, right? So the average score of Super Bowl advertising is a surprisingly low 2.7 on our 5-star system. You'd be surprised, right? But that's because there are a lot of 1-star rubbish Super Bowl ads. There are also a lot of good ones, but the average is 2.7. What do you think the average of a Super Bowl ad with a celebrity is?
1.6.
Yeah, lower.
It's the same. It's exactly the same. It's 2.7, right? So there's... Now, there are some good celebrities, some bad celebrities, but celebrity makes no difference. On average.
More entertaining, but less branded.
The trick, I think, is you need to use the celebrity mustn't be the hero. It needs to be you. The celebrity is the supporting act, not the lead act. I think that's the first thing. The second thing, the celebrity should be used for the thing that they're famous for, right? So, you know, I'm just thinking, if it's Ryan Reynolds.
Beyonce singing, you know.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it needs to be relevant to the idea. So it needs to be authentic, right? Now, the average star score for an ad with a fluent device, so characters or scenarios, so we've talked about both, characters or scenarios, so we combine them together, is 3.7. It gives you an extra star. So things like the M&M's characters, for example, or You're Not You When You're Hungry, you know. These kind of creative ideas, both characters and scenarios, are worth a star. And the great thing is they cost you nothing.
Yeah.
Compared to a celebrity, right? Imagine all the money you save by not having, I'd love to have Ryan Reynolds,
I think you're right. Look, I worked over in America for a while and I was lucky to do a few Super Bowl spots, but I think what happens is,
I love how he drops that in. Yeah, I was in America, did a few Super Bowl spots, came back.
I'm rejecting saying it, bro.
Did I mention I lived in New York? What I was going to say is I think often the celebrity is the de facto for an idea, right? Like there's no real idea, but we'll just get a celebrity and that sort of makes up for the lack of an idea. I think that's why you see that low sort of average score that you mentioned. But then if you think about, you know, the really famous memorable Super Bowl spots, whether it's the Budweiser horse, right? you know, that has that device, has that sort of, you know, ownable thing, that there's a reason why they always win in the ad meter and they always, you know, are the most effective ads of the day. It makes a lot of sense.
The only thing you said though before, which I think is possibly incorrect, is that it costs you nothing. It costs you bloody millions and millions to build up to it. You just can't walk up out of the gate and say, here's my Fluent device.
Yeah.
And that's the issue. And then you've got to get back to consistency and confidence in that Fluent device. Yeah. And you've got to be strategic about it. You've got to be strategic about saying, right, we're going to create Cornelius the rooster, or we're going to create the Oreo twist or whatever it always should have gone as Becksavers. And I don't think people realize marketers realize when they've got a Fluent device, when they do. And then
we get sick of them, right? We get bored of them.
Hey, but it was a really good question from Brent before about everything you've learned, right? From and all the advice you'd give the CMOs about their creative process. Number one is you've said is create a character or as
Fluent device. Fluent device. Fluent device. It could be an idea. It could be a scenario.
I reckon Telstra's going to have a dancing man in a suit. So
With a phone.
I can just feel it. What else? What else, John?
So we're talking generally CMO or specifically in terms of advertising.
You're telling them everything they should do with their creative output from everything you've learned from system one.
Okay. All right. So creative output wise. Okay, cool. So number one, I start with a Fluent device. That's absolutely key. Number two is I'd probably now obviously we got planning in terms of long and short. That's really, really important. So one of the biggest challenge today when I speak to CMOs around the world is how do you make the case for long-term brand building? And if I were to pick my favorite Ehrenberg Bass data point, it's their 95-5 rule, which is 95% of people are not in market to buy today. That is flipping game changing. When you understand that one data point, it's funny, right? It's like anything in research, right? It's like, it all makes bloody sense, really. But for some reason, as marketers, we sit here going, everybody is thinking about my chewing gum at the moment. You know what I mean? It's like, no, they're not, you know? They're buying it twice a year, right? This is the sad reality of marketing, is that most people are trying to ignore you, right? So, you know, so the 95% rule, I think, is one of the most important things. So the second thing would be you've got to balance long and short, and you've got to make the case for it in the business. And it's a hard case to make, because the default position will be, give me results tomorrow, give me results this week, give me results this month, right? And I've been there and I get it. So making the case for long and short. Now that partly, by the way, to go back to point number one, is why point number one is so good. Fluent devices connect the long and the short in magical ways. And again, we've tested, you know, activation advertising using Fluent devices, and it works much, much harder. And it creates more emotion because people, you know, get your idea and get, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it triggers good memory, you know, it triggers emotion, it triggers memories as well, which is fantastic. So balancing long and short, I think, is super important. And then I'd say, in terms of how to make advertising effective, what's lovely about working System One is, oh boy, we've got so much good advice on how to do it, which is just insane. So, I mean, I could probably, you know, spend the entire rest of the podcast explaining it, but in real summary, for example, the power of soundtracks, you know, the power of characters. I mean, my colleague Orlando, who's just flipping Mr., you know, Jedi master at this kind of stuff. I mean, the work he's done on how advertising works, once you read it, it's like flipping, like, you know, someone's just like giving you the source code. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, right, that's how it works, you know. And, you know, there's so much evidence out there for how memories are created, how emotion is created, and how it all works. And really, there's no excuse, because there's a lot out there that if you take the time, and again, this is why maybe I wouldn't have been fired if I'd worked this stuff out earlier. But anyway, you
know. But do you think though we're starting to get a situation where marketers have sort of got the playbook, right? Now, all this stuff you're talking about, you know, we've read the marketing science. We know you need the Fluent device, need the right level of long term branding, need to get the soundtrack going. All this. Do you think that then means that marketers have less intuition? Do you think they're too busy working through the playbook, working through the framework of an idea as opposed to just feeling an idea? Do you get a sense of that?
I really like that question because, interestingly, one of the things I love about System One is it kind of backs up my intuition. And, you know, so before when I didn't use System One, I used there are actually, believe it or not, other ways of testing advertising other than System One. I shouldn't really admit that, but there are. And when I've used some of the other ways of testing advertising, like focus groups, but I'm not necessarily talking about competitors, but even like a focus group is, you often get some really useless feedback that isn't really, it's very unhelpful. So I'll give you an example, right? And this is a should have gone to System One kind of advert, actually. So I got pitched this idea. I was working on LucasAid, and it was the Men's World Cup. And we were a sponsor of the men's football team, and we were trying to get into women's football, right? So we were sponsoring the Lionesses as well as the national men's team. And the agency pitched this idea, right? And I'm sure you guys have the ad you should have made that you never made that you regret, right? This is mine. So they came and pitched this idea. And sorry, I realize you might need to know a little bit about English football to follow this one, right? But I presume most people have heard of Wayne Rooney, right? So he's one of the most kind of successful English footballers of all time. He's an Everton boy through and through. He then went on to Manchester United and, he's captain England, scored a lot of goals, right? Anyway, this film that they pitched to me, bear in mind, we're about to sponsor the women's football team. So basically opens in a hospital, opens in Everton, which is in Liverpool. And, you kind of see like a boy being born. You see a child being born. Then you see basically some football happening. And then, and then you see like kind of a contract being signed. And there's a voiceover that goes, I was born under the shadow of Stanley Park. I was I turned up for the local boys team. I then got signed. I was the youngest player ever to play for Everton. I then went on to get poached by a major Manchester team. I've then captained my country and I've gone on to score more goals than anyone else. And you see this action unfolding. It's just amazing, right? And then it cuts and goes, hi, my name's Tony Duggan. I'm the captain of the England women's team. And the captain of the England women's team has got exactly the same story as Wayne Rooney. And you've never heard of her. Now, you have now, because, the women's game is a different thing now than it was then. This is back in 2016, by the way. And we were going to put that spot in the Men's World Cup. And I was just like, look, they present it to me. I had like tingles going down my spine going, oh, this is just amazing. And I literally said, that is a 5-star ad that we are going to make. And I was just, I walked out the room like with no doubts whatsoever in my head, we were making this thing, right? I went and told the CEO. He was like, man, that is amazing. You got to do this. This is incredible. And we were also doing a deal with the FA at the time to sponsor the Lionesses, the whole thing. So it just beautifully wrapped up. And I then made a mistake because I'd agreed with the team that we would research whatever idea we did. Oh, what a bad decision. Because I researched the idea. And do you know what people are going, oh, I thought you were talking about Wayne Rooney in the feedback. And they're going, people don't get the idea. I'm like, they're not supposed, that's the point. That is the idea, is they don't get the idea. So the researchers come and said, no, it doesn't deliver your strategy. Your strategy, whatever the strategy we come up with. I'm like, I don't care. The execution is better than strategy in this case, right? So we're going to reverse our strategy out into this because this is way better. Because people will talk about this ad. This ad will be in the news. People will be inspired by it. People want to go out and, play football, and this will change the women's game. And yeah, like you imagine the whole thing, right? Anyway, so we ended up doing something else. And I just like, for the life of me, anyway, the reason I work with System One is I was telling this story to the founder of System One, who's also called John Kieran. And he said, I'll test it for you. And he tested it. And it's a 5-star idea.
He tested as a script.
Yeah. And he came back and he was like, you were right. So back to your point about intuition is like, The reason why I'm passionate about System One and not other approaches is because actually it typically is my intuition. What it's doing is it's validating intuition and the kind of creative instincts that we as marketers and creative agencies have, but it allows us to frame it in a way that the business can buy into. Otherwise, it's just us, you know, shooting the breeze. Otherwise,
yeah, just using a system two approach to justify a system one lie, as you've said it. It just still worries me a little bit. And if it is all about confidence, then it's kind of confidence in a system that is the opposite of what we're trying to educate people on. So we're educating people on system one, system two, how the world thinks, how marketers actually make decisions, how humans actually make decisions and so forth. And then we say, and our justification for this is a bit of system two over here.
Yeah.
It worries me a little bit that we're telling organizations to not be confident in their own judgment and educating them on how to be confident in their own judgment rather than relying on a star system. So it probably is an imperfect, it's a very good system. It's been well
yeah.
Lauded and so forth. But just still the fundamentals of that.
Yeah. Approach. I mean, a couple of things to so the first principle, which I think is probably principle number one of marketing today, is you are not the customer as well. So like what we try and do is just get a representative sample from the crowd to tell you how they feel about what you're doing. And that's like, it's kind of like feedback, proper feedback, isn't it? It's, and you know, we can, you know, as I said, I gave you a great example there of, I think, where my instinct was absolutely on the money. But it not always is. And so I think what system one can do is almost be that sense check, either to validate and then give you the confidence double down, or sometimes to challenge you. I'll give you a separate example, actually, where I was wrong. So I was working on, Luke said, energy, and we were coming up with a new campaign, and we landed this mother of an idea, which was energy beats everything. It's an energy drink. And we were basically saying, like, doesn't matter how talented you are, unless you've got the energy and the passion and determination, you're not going to achieve anything, right? Which is quite a profound insight. And therefore, as an energy drink, we could be fueling success, right? And therefore, you know, like, and so we thought, what are the greatest ways to exaggerate energy conquering anything, right? And we ended up with David versus Goliath as the idea, you know, like little shepherd boy takes on the kind of big bully in the village type thing. Anyway, the team at the time had pitched 7 ideas to me, and it was one of the most brilliant creative like meetings I've had in my life. I mean, the team were on fire. They were in pairs. They came in, they pitched 15 minutes each, the idea. I could have bought anything. You know, I was just like absolutely loving it. And they started with this idea, David and Goliath, going, this is the really simple way to tell the story. Boom. I'm like, love it. Great. What else you got? Every idea was getting better and better. And then the final one, I was absolutely buzzing about. And it was so good. And it was so good, in fact, I was trying to cast myself in the ad because I was already kind of like acting it out. And it was just like the funniest thing. And we were killing ourselves. You know, when you get an idea and you're building on the idea live and going, oh, yeah, and this could happen and that could happen. And then imagine it here and there and everywhere, right? The whole thing was amazing. So I left that meeting absolutely buzzing about this idea. Anyway, back to my you're not the customer, right? So we put all 7 into the system one test overnight to give us the feedback. And I walked into the meeting confident that my final kind of route, I say my team, not my, I didn't come up with it, they did. But the one that I had kind of almost cast myself in was the absolute slam dunk. I was completely wrong. It was the first idea. And I learned something. And the thing I learned was the customer didn't have a 2-hour brainstorm on my idea. And that's the difference. And the simplest going back to the first conversation, make it easy. The simplest articulation of an idea is very often the best one. It's rarely the cleverest, the funniest, the one that's strategically knitted together in the most perfect blanket. You know what I mean? But actually, the simplest articulation of something is often what most people will understand and get because they're bombarded with millions of messages from other people. Now, funnily enough, you know, they're not just thinking about you. And that was a massive lesson. So we ended up making the first idea, which I'd got bored of, actually, to be quite honest, but turned out to be the best one. And that's I think one of you two said it earlier, actually. We get bored of our work, don't we, long before the consumers even started to understand it. And that's probably one of the most fundamental issues in all of marketing. Is we throw out the door a load of stuff that's working and we create a load of new stuff that's not working. I mean, the waste is off the scale.
We've actually got something kind of fun to show you now, speaking of some of your work and what consumers might think of it. So, John, Made to Move on Lucas A with Anthony Joshua. Do you just want to explain the idea that you're trying to set up quickly to our listeners?
Yeah, 100%. And by the way, this, so I know we're having a bit of ping pong about are our instincts right or wrong, right? This was an instinct right moment. So the background to it is we'd done a bit of work on Lucas's sport. The insight was absolutely tight. It was basically, as humans, we are made to move, right? That, it's a truism about human beings. We're on this planet to move. And at Lucas's sport, our role was to help. Very simple, that, right? So as humans, we're made to move. Lucas's sport is here to help. And it's simple as that. So the simple idea we had is that everything we do will help you move. And we set this mission to get 1 million people moving more, because moving more has so many benefits: mental health, physical health, sociability, anxiety, everything, right? So everything improves, when you exercise. We all know that. It's a basic, but we're a sports drink, so therefore that was our role. Now, we had hired Anthony Joshua as one of our ambassadors. We had a roster of ambassadors, but he was probably one of the most successful that we had, because we'd hired him as an amateur. He'd gone on then to become very famous. Now, he was at the time of writing, I say this was the end of the financial year, in December, in March, he has had his biggest ever fight. He was fighting Klitschko in Wembley, in front of 90,000 people, televised on Sky, right? It was his biggest single moment. Now, the creative at Grey, literally, I remember Dom, amazing creative, he literally kind of barged in the door and was like, I've got to show you something. And I'm like, dude, I'm busy, in a meeting, whatever. He said, no, you've got to see this. And he told me the script he had. And it's a bit like the kind of Women's World Cup idea as well. I'm like, man, that's good. And his basic pitch to me was, nobody has told AJ's story. And he said, what I'd love you to do is I'd love you to buy the entire ad break before he goes out to fight Klitschko. And what I want to do in the ad break is tell the story of him being born through to him walking out in front of the crowd, and then to see him actually walk out live in front of the crowd. So this would almost be telling the story and then the real event happens. I'm like, oh, mate, that is just absolutely superb. And I'd tingle so much fun. And it's one of the few moments in my life where I've said, do you know what? I don't need to see this idea again. Go and make it. And I said to him, I've only got two requests of you, which is a really odd thing to say. Request number one, I don't want to see the brand popping up all over the place in an incongruous way. Just have it at the end, right? Because I want people to feel it, right? But number one. Number two, I want you to leave a pause of at least 3 seconds at the end of the ad, because I felt something. I was literally spine tingling, and I don't want to cut that feeling out by going boom straight into the action. I want you to leave it hanging for at least 3 seconds, so people really let that feeling hang around. So that was my only creative feedback. So I'd love to say I was in there shaping it in the editing suite. I was the one that, honestly, that's one where I just did nothing. The idea was so good.
What's interesting about that is you're kind of going against what a lot of the, like I said before, the playbook of marketing science would tell you to do. Oh, can't bring the brand to the end. Certainly not after a 3 second pause. Like, you made some big calls there that are not.
Orlando would not be happy with you, John. There was no fluent device. But now, so we do something here where we put people's pieces of work to the pub test, and we show them in a pub and see what they think. Now the people we showed were in Australia, and they may not have the context that you've given us here. But let's have a listen to what they think of the ad.
I'm not really sure what Lucozade is. I think it has something to do with sport.
A little bit emotional, because I'm a mum, and you just see all that, like, all those moments in time that, like, you think are irrelevant, and all these bits and pieces that get you to where you are today. So,
I think it's empowering. It's like a pretty emotional journey, if I'm being honest.
It makes me wonder what it is and who that guy is, and what he has to do with Lucozade.
I didn't notice any product placement in that at all.
Well, I didn't know if it promoted Lucozade enough in the ad. It was beautifully short, and I loved the story of it, but I'm not sure that I related it to Lucozade.
I don't know. I don't have much to do with Lucozade. I think it's more of a UK brand.
I feel like it was trying to use Anthony Joshua
to show an emotional narrative that's like moving and motivational.
Building to be better, to keep like growth, and it's trying to link that with Lucas Age.
I think it's trying to show that there's all these moments in time that get you to where you're going or need to go, and you'll get knocked down, and there'll be times where things don't go your way, you make bad decisions, but you've just got to keep, you know, moving forward and keep trying and resilience and keep going.
But I think it's about overcoming adversity.
I think it passes the pub test, definitely, but I'm not sure how good it is about promoting the product.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so, no.
Yeah, I think this passes the pub test. It's, you know, it's very cinematic.
Lovely ad. Don't know the brand. It's not surprising. In Australia, Lucas Age, it's not a power brand like it is in the UK.
Yeah.
No. Anyway, but and they missed the whole context of the ad as well, which I think is hard to test sometimes as well.
Yeah. I mean, some good comments in there. I liked the lady near the beginning as a mum. Mm. Really interesting insight this, because AJ was about to go into lockdown, as he calls it, which is the period of time before he does a big fight. He basically about 8 weeks, doesn't talk to anyone. And we pitched this idea to him, and he was so chuffed with this idea. He's like, I'm honored, you know, that you do this, blah, blah, blah. I love that you're telling this story, all that kind of thing. But he said to the team, like, the only problem is, like, unless you can come out to Dubai, like, I'm at a weekend with my family at the water park or whatever, unless you can come out there, that's the only time I've got free. So a couple of guys in the team flew out, spent the weekend with AJ, getting to know him, and they came back, and I said, what did you find out, sort of thing. And you know what they said to me? They said, his mum. They said, that's the story, his mum. He is so tight with his mum. And so in the story, what you see, we open with him being born, he's got his arms up, you know, she's trying to help him take his first steps. And then we close with him putting his hands up, you know, as a victor in the boxing ring. And then we pan back to the same scene where the mum's holding the arms up, helping him take his first steps. And there's the scene where his mum gets him out of jail. And, you know, right at the end, he's kind of back in his mum's flat. The flat we show in the ad, which is a council estate in North London, is where he lived until very recently with his mum, right? It's all true. So it's like, you know, about really understanding, you know, somebody and getting the insight and then discovering what the real story is. The real emotional connection is him and his mum. So it's really fascinating that. But look, I think—
Did you test it? John, did you test it?
No, we didn't test it, no. And I think to answer your question, because I know where you're going with this, is the context was everything. Now, this is the cheapest media buy I've done in my life. We bought 5 spots, right? We bought the spot, which was like, as in the fight, the outbreak before, and there were some Champions League games happening in the week running up to it, and we cherry picked it. So I think I had 5 GRPs or something like that. I mean, it was like the tiniest media buy I've ever made. However, it was the most efficient, because we had something like 300,000 social media comments. Lennox Lewis tweeted it and said, proper ad. Lucas Age, well done, all that kind of thing. So what we were trying to do is enter the conversation in the weekend where everybody— I mean, that, by the way, that year was a quiet year for sport. This was probably the biggest sporting occasion happening that year, you know, and it got, you know, enormous, enormous amount of headlines. And we were talked about all weekend because of the ad sort of thing. So,
and yeah. beyond those measures of talkability, and which are great, did it work?
Yeah, it did actually. So the brand that year was up, I think, about 12%. Now it's the number one. In fact, the brand had been challenged because I think when I joined— I mean, I'm not taking credit for this, by the way. Stephen, who was head of marketing, is the one that deserves the credit here. The brand had 5 years of decline, to the point at which retailers were rethinking the actual category of sports drinks, because, you know, consumers were leaving the category. It was losing its relevance. There were other kinds of energy drinks like Monster and Red Bull that were taking over the space in store, you know what I mean? So it was getting squeezed as a category. And that year we turned it around and got the brand into growth. In fact, we had double digit growth for 3 years after that point. And it's also worth remembering that no one bit of creative is the whole campaign. So that bit of creative was effectively the sort of the poster child for the made to move idea. And we executed the idea through loads of different channels. So we had an app that, you know, anyone basically that tracked your steps, and the more steps you did, the more prizes you got. You know, you can imagine the kind of thing. So we had the app, we had in-store activity, we had other kind of above the line communication happening as well. So that was designed to basically be, I suppose for us, that was the ultimate mood film of the idea. And that was the beginning of everything else that we did.
And of course, won a couple of lines at Cannes.
I know, it did. It did, which I'm very proud of. I mean, I've met a lot of people on the podcast that have won a lot more lines than me, but I always come back. I entered 2-1-2. So my hit rate's pretty good.
John, I reckon we can wrap it up about there. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for expressing your creative output both pre-podcast and then also just sharing some of your insights around building the podcast and building your own sense of fame and how that relates back to System One as well. It's been fascinating. So thank you heaps.
My pleasure. It's good to hang out and good to see some fellow black t-shirt wearers.
Thanks, John.
God bless.
Cheers, guys.
What do you think, Graham?
I think it's interesting that a lot of marketers, and I was actually talking to a few just yesterday, are kind of a bit hesitant on the whole personal brand thing. They kind of feel like, oh, no, I need to focus internally. I need to really, be in service of the business. And that's true. But I think John's an excellent example of how you can actually turn a personal brand into something that's really good for your business, especially if you're in B2B, right?
Well, if you're in B2B, there's no excuse because your customers are basically the people you're generating fame against. But in for any CMO, the more famous they are, the more influential they're going to be internally and the better talent they're going to attract. And so, it's something I kind of encourage the marketers who I come up against to do.
Why do you think the hesitance is, Adam, with a lot?
I think most CMOs want to be taken more credibly.
Yeah,
and I think it's, does the organization see this as credible or not? I think some organizations are geared that way and get it. Some organizations aren't. So if you're fighting against the culture of your organization, then don't do it. If your organization aligns against that kind of brand building philosophy, then go nuts. But I reckon that's one of the key decision. Now, did I hear right that all the world of market research has all contributes to the fact that you should put a character in your ad? is that all boil down to having Cornelius the Cornflake Rooster?
Well, I think I disagree with that clearly. I mean, I think that's the danger with all this marketing science giving us almost a checklist of what we need to, do creatively in order to be effective. And I think what that does is, I see it. I see so much advertising that's trying to, check all the boxes as opposed to being, just a genuinely original, emotional story, And so I think that's a tension that every marketer is sort of fighting. I do think if it was as easy as just follow the instructions, right, then I think we'd have a whole bunch of like really effective advertising. You and I both know that most advertising is not effective.
I think it is that easy. And we have a saying, which is simple or wonderful, but nothing in between. So if it's going to be simple, then put a character in your ad. Get a soundtrack, get an ownable piece of music, get your media buy board on continuity, pay attention to all the basics and do that as best you can. That's simple. If you want to go for wonderful, if you've got a culture that supports that, if you're up for that, then there's other ways to get unfair share of mental availability or whatever you want to say. And so I do reckon the marketing sciences can make average marketing really, really good. And, you follow all the rules, you follow all the checkbooks, you can at least do average marketing better than anybody else. but then you can just go for some, you can use that as a foundation to go for the bigger swings if you want.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it. I think that's a good way to look at it. I think if you want to get to great or wonderful, as you say, I don't think there's a checklist to follow.
You start to wander out into the bush on your own and start to go. Is that, 100%.
Righto, well, that was a goodie.
Yeah, simple and wonderful, nothing in between. God bless Brent, and see you soon.
Later.